Ben Helf got Reel 2.
It so happens that my hometown, that is Piotrków Trybunalski, was the first ghetto in Poland. We were informed as early as the beginning of October that we were to move out from certain certain parts of the home of our town into a designated area, which was very much predominantly Jewish. And we were told that by the 1st of November we had to move in there. Now, that of course caused a tremendous amount of commotion, because the question of finding a house or accommodation was really very difficult. To start off with, the people who lived in this particular area already lived in very small apartments. There were apartments of one or two rooms. If somebody had three rooms, that was a lot. And in some cases, they were already sharing with other families who came from other areas. So it became a very acute problem. My father was running around to try and find a place, and obviously we didn't want to take the first best place, and it was a question of choosing who one is going to live with, because it wasn't the question of getting one a place on one's own. One had to share a flat together with other families. Now, we were a family of five, and therefore it wasn't all that simple. However, we managed to get a reasonable place at that stage, because it was a friend of my father's who was living there. In fact, he was a brother of an uncle of mine, who lived in another place altogether, but this man lived there, and he said he was rather worried that if he's not going to take us in, that they will allocate people whom he doesn't know and he doesn't want to live, so he asked us to come and stay there. Well, we moved in, and not only did we have to move in, because we lived outside that part, but also Jews who lived in the surrounding areas, in the small villages, and what's more, there were also other Jews who are now being driven out from areas which Germany incorporated into the Third Reich. Part of Poland was incorporated into the Third Reich, and that was and the border was now about 15 kilometers from my hometown. And one of the earliest exiles from their home, were people who lived very near the former British border, German border. They belonged to a very ancient Jewish community. It was altogether a very ancient town. It was the first Polish capital. When Poland was founded in 966, this town was then the capital. It was called Gniezno. These people were really had a more of a German background than a Polish background. They were driven out and they were sent to our hometown. Now, when they arrived, it was around the end of November, and there was no room for them. At the time we were living one on top of the other. So they were housed in what used to be the main synagogue of the town, and also one of the clubs, which was known as the Maccabi Club. Now, the synagogue, I want to say something about the synagogue, because I will be repeating scene in the synagogue, because a lot of things happened around the synagogue. Very sad history around the synagogue. Synagogue was one of the most beautiful architectural structures that one could ever imagine. We happen to be a very proud community, and there are certain things that our community was always striving for a kind of excellence. To have a great synagogue was one of them. to have a top canter was another. So much so that the community brought back a man who emigrated to South America, and he used to sing on radio in South America. He had the most fantastic voice. And inside the synagogue, there were the most beautiful carvings, descriptions, murals, windows. It was just something. It was a peace to be in that place alone was a great experience. And the surrounding of this cantor singing and the beauty of the synagogue was a great experience. Now this synagogue was turned into a place of habitation, and 500 people were forced to live there. They built bunks one on top of the other, about 5-6 high, and that's where these people who came from a very well-to-do community, very cultured community, and suddenly this is where they found their place. They of course were completely impoverished, and the humiliation was even more devastating for them. It didn't take a long time before these people started dying off, and it didn't take a long time before they contracted disease and typhoid. In fact, it was from this place that the whole town was infected with typhoid. And so we had a new problem where people had to be taken out of their homes and they had to be quarantined. And at that stage, I want to go back because when we moved into the ghetto, the Germans ordered the president of the ghetto to form a kind of Jewish government, so that he would run the show. They would order him to deliver if they needed 100 Jews or 200 Jews or whatever, and so the administration inside would be controlled by the Jews with instructions by the Gestapo.
Is this what the Germans called the Judenrat?
Judenrat. That's right. It was called the Judenrat. It's the Jewish Council. So, of course, one had to form a Jewish police. And when the epidemic started, then one formed also a sanitary police. Now, in the main, those who became policemen to start off with were young people. They were very much of a mixed crowd. Some of them came from well-to-do families. Some came from not so well-to-do families. Some had a very good education. And some who didn't have such a good education merely got their position because of their forcefulness and because of their in a way, a kind of greater collaboration with the Germans. Now, it was interesting. This is a story on its own that one can talk about and one can evaluate. But, I mean, this is not something that I can take time up with it. But the behavior of the Jewish police varied greatly. It wasn't really a question of what kind of a home one came from. There was one policeman, for instance, who came from a most wonderful home. His father was a teacher who was very much beloved by everybody, man with a great sense of duty, great sense of humor. Altogether came from a very wonderful background, wonderful family. But the son, for some reason or other, he grew up to hate himself because he was a Jew. He did not want to be a Jew. He wanted to be a Pole. And he was, to such an extent, he was such a Polish patriot that before the war, I don't know how it happened, but there were the Polish government asked for volunteers to be to become living torpedoes, and he was such a patriot that he put his name down to be a living torpedo. But anyway, he was in the ghetto, and he was one of the earliest collaborators with the German, the Gestapo. And of course, the Gestapo ordered the Judenrat to make him a policeman. And as a policeman, he was a very, very dangerous man, because whatever he could report to the Germans, he would report to the Germans. Later on, he did a tremendous amount of damage, but that at this stage, he was already very much of a feared man. Now, he wasn't the only one. There were many others who, for all kinds of reasons, decided to behave that way. Now, the conditions in the ghetto varied greatly. Those people who came in from outside with very few means, because most of it was taken away from them, were, unfortunately, the first victims. They were the ones who were to suffer first, and they were the ones who were to die. I mentioned the Jews of Gniezno. By the time it came to 1942, about three quarters of these people, there were 5,000 of them, I should have mentioned the figure. It wasn't 5,000, it was 1,500, sorry. 1,500 of them that came, and there were very few left by the time it came to 1942. By the time we were deported. But others as well from surrounding towns found great difficulty because whilst the Germans were receiving rations, it was a question of how much money one had and how many valuables one had and how many possessions one had. Because all the time people were selling off whatever they had, and they used to sell them either to those who could afford to have them, or, and these in turn used to sell them to the Poles. Now, there was, however, because we were the first ghetto, for some reason or other, it was never a closed ghetto, like so many other ghettos that were closed. But at the end of the ghetto, and the beginning of the Aryan area, there was the sign, stop, and it said quite clearly that Jews must not get out of the ghetto. Any Jew found outside the ghetto will be shot. And of course people were taking risks and they were going out of the ghetto. People were shot, but nevertheless, hunger somehow drives people to the point of desperation, and people rather took their lives in their hands, and they decided that they had to do something to feed their family. Now, there were, of course, one could go outside the ghetto in an official way. And that is, one found a kind of an employment outside, so one got a permit. Then one used to get permits to go out, especially when the Germans attacked Russia, and the Germans suddenly were confronted with the Russian winter. The Germans then needed furs. And this, so they had all kinds of agents going around the villages buying skin, rabbit skin, especially. Now, my father used to deal a lot with the farmers all around the town, because he used to buy their produce, he used to buy their wheat, their corn. And so he was very well known all around. And right away from the very beginning, when we moved into the ghetto, my father used to bring in food into the ghetto. He was dealing with food most of the time, and he was using his wide connections that he had. And he was using it mainly through our own mill, because most of the people who worked for my father continued to work in that mill. So they were cooperating with my father. Of course, my father rewarded them very highly for it. But nevertheless, he used to take great risks to smuggle this food in into the ghetto. From time to time, the goods were confiscated, and there were all kinds of inquiries. But somehow, my father used to write about it. He managed to get out in every case. Now, I remember a certain episode, which is worthwhile relating, where I come into it. From time to time, the Germans used to make periodic, what they called, periodic searches. And so they closed the ghetto, surrounded the ghetto with gendarmes and Gestapo, and they went in searching houses for all kinds of goods, for clandestine meetings or whatever. And one morning, it happened to be the morning when my father arranged for a delivery of flour to come into the ghetto. You see, my father did not do it himself. He paid others to do it. And this was a Pole, who incidentally used to work for my father before the war, and he was in one of the villages he was bringing in flour. My father got very worried, because he thought, what if he would be coming straight into the lion's nest. So I had a bright idea. You see, I used to spend a lot of time outside the ghetto. For some reason or other, I sort of used to, it was sort of like a game, a daring game. I sort of felt I got tremendous satisfaction of being able to move around, being outside. I used to be told off by my mother when she found out about it, and then I never used to tell her, because she was getting very annoyed with me, and from time to time she used to give me a hiding, because she made me promise that I wouldn't get out there. But I did. And so at that stage I was already 11, 12 years old, and I was growing up very fast. I really was years ahead of my time. I was also, I felt very strong. Whether I was or not, I don't know. But I, in relation to other boys, I definitely was. I certainly had a tremendous amount of confidence in me. And we happened to live right on the border of the ghetto. The wall that separated our house, the other side of the was an adjoining house, was already outside the ghetto. And the other thing that I used to do, because I didn't go to school, there was no schooling anymore, so there was very little for me to do other than to find my own distractions and my own hobbies and my own kind of entertainment. So we used to play a lot with other boys, of course. But the things I used to do, I used to climb over walls. I used to jump about from one story high, and I used to challenge myself always doing these things. And I did precisely this. I used to do this. I used to always go over the wall. I used to jump on the other side down, which was quite a long way down. And I turned around to my father and I said to him, "Look, I know where the place is. You've taken me there once, and I will take my satchel, put in some books, and I'll pretend that I'm going to school, that I'm a Polish boy, because I always used to pretend that I'm a Polish boy when I used to be on the other side, and that I'll go to school. My father says no, because it's very dangerous. My mother says no, under no circumstances. And my father sort of in desperation, he said, "Well, okay, if you think you can do it, we'll try it." Now, it so happens that in my hometown, well, in every Polish town, there was also a large German community living. There were, before the war in Poland, 3.5 million Jews, and there were 3.5 million Poles, 3.5 million Germans living. And in our town, there was even a German church, an evangelical church, and the evangelical church was right across the road from where our building was, the other side, where it was already outside the ghetto. And the verger of that church had three sons. They were absolute horrors. Already before the war, they used to attack Jewish boys. Now, fortunately for me, I did not live there before the war, and I don't think they knew me. And they saw me from time to time. They used to see me with some Polish boys, and I really had very little connection with them. I was never sure. I never was sure whether they knew I was a Jew. I wasn't Jewish. But the point was that when I jumped over the fence and I got onto the other house, and then I went out of the I went into the streets, I was confronted with two gendarmes. And they stopped me. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning. They stopped me and they said, "Halt! Where are you going? Wohin gehst du?" And I turned around and said, "I'm going to school." I pretended in a very broken German, "Ich Schule." And with these gendarmes were two of the three brothers were standing with him. When I saw them, I thought to myself, that's my end, because I was absolutely convinced that they are going to denounce me. But to my surprise, they turned around to these two gendarmes and said, "Yes, he's a Pole," because the gendarmes looked at them, because they were the ones who knew everybody. So off I went, I got outside, and I ran. Probably, I've never run, I used to run subsequently, I used to run quite a lot, but I don't think I've ever run as fast or as long a distance as I did this time, because this was about 10 kilometers outside my town. The village, a place called Moschenice, I still remember it, was there, and I ran, because I wanted to get quickly to this pole to let them know not to bring in the flower. Well, I got there just in time. He was already ready to go, and I said, "Haven't you heard what's happening?" He says, "No." He says, "Oh, there are searches going on in the ghetto, and people are being killed, and it's a lot of problems. So please, my father told me to tell you, you must not do anything until further notice." Oh. Right, I told him. And I felt very, very happy, because I have achieved my first mission. It was really one of my first missions. And I felt I made a contribution to our existence. And then, of course, coming back, I took my time. By the time I got back, it was already about 12 o'clock, half past 12 in the afternoon. And the searches at that stage already stopped. I got back. Of course, my mother was terribly worried. And when she saw me, and then when I told her what happened, I told my father what happened, they were absolutely overjoyed. And that day, I was really feeling like a king, because it was. I still remember now. I sort of felt that I've saved. I've done something so important. You know, my imagination at the time was really working on a very vast scale, you see, because I had, as I explained earlier, there was no outlet for children. Most children really had to worry about food. I was fortunate that I had a father who cared and who could manage to shield me, so to speak. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. And I used to spend my time always imagining doing all kinds of things. And I would imagine I would fly and I would bring food in. And it's really amazing when I think back the kind of images that went into my head. I used to read a tremendous amount. I used to get hold of books that really were beyond me. I remember reading one of the books I read was La Miserable, which I found very exciting. The reason why I found that book so exciting was because it so happens that about a year before the war started, there was a picture made which was called La Miserable, and I remember I was too young to be taken to see it. And when I first, during the war, when I was a little bit older, when I saw that book, I decided that I would read it. And I was very impressed with the whole story. It made a very, very impression. But I really read practically every cowboy book that was available. Whatever was available, books that were very much above my age, I used to read and I used to swallow them really within 24 hours.
Were there many books available in the ghetto?
Well, there were books available because people, after all, people did possess them before the war. There were libraries before the war. It wasn't all taken away. It wasn't all burned. A lot of it was always, people hid quite a lot. Some people, in order to make a living, were lending books. The life in the ghetto was rather interesting, you see, because after a very short time, people just settled down. You see, at first we always thought that the war is going to come to an end, that we had a great belief in the power of Britain and France, and especially when Churchill took over from Chamberlain. Chamberlain was a very unpopular man. Then everybody rejoiced and thought, well, now, of course, there will be a turn of the tide and the war will soon be finished. So we were living from day to day on a really with the hope that it won't last long. Of course, in the meantime, the news that we were getting was absolutely shattering because the Germans kept on attacking one nation after another. And they used to overwhelm the countries with even in a shorter time than they overwhelmed Poland. They all fell one after the other, and then when they attacked Belgium and France and Holland, and France collapsed within in no time, again it was to us something that hit us very strongly. But nevertheless,
did people begin to feel there was no hope?
No, on the contrary, because there were always those people who, the armchair politicians, and people who were academically very highly skilled, qualified, who used to argue that no matter what is happening, the Germans are going to lose. Of course, we used to hear the German news, and the German news was always that they destroyed 100 British planes, and 3 or 5 German planes did not return. There was never a case of a German plane being destroyed. They never returned, but it was always a percentage. The comparison was such that it was that they created a credibility gap. Of course, there was no BBC for us. We couldn't listen. I mean, anybody possessing a radio was immediately destined to be killed. So there may have been some people, there may have been a radio here and there, but I wasn't aware of any radio around. First of all, there was a curfew in the ghetto. We were only allowed to walk, to be in the ghetto up to 8 o'clock. And at 8 o'clock, we had to be behind the wall, so to speak, inside. So we people used to spend a lot of time with our neighbors. Either they used to come in to us, or we used to go to them, and some played cards. That's when I learned to play cards as well. Some sitting discussing politics, some were discussing how it used to be, and all kinds of things they were doing. And again, for me, it was always a great education. I used to...